This is Gabfest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political Gabfest, a constitutional showdown between the CIA and the Senate. Also, was it undignified for the president to shill for Obamacare on Between Two Ferns? I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Julia Turner. On this week's Culture Gabfest, the promise and problems of the virtual currency Bitcoin. Then, the TV science series Cosmos gets a 21st century reboot. And then, director Wes Anderson's idiosyncratic world now includes a place to stay for the night, the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Back to work.
Mr. Gustav?
Yes?
Me and the boys talked it over. We think you're a real straight fellow.
Well, I've never been accused of that before, but I appreciate the sentiment.
We'll start with the Political Gabfest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in New York. Senator Dianne Feinstein took to the floor of the Senate to accuse the CIA of violating the separation of powers by spying on Senate staffers. The CIA counters that Senate staffers were stealing secret CIA documents. It's a constitutional showdown, the likes of which we have not seen for decades. And then President Obama goes on the parody talk show Between Two Ferns to pitch Obamacare. Bill O'Reilly says Abe Lincoln is spinning in his grave and the dignity of the presidency has been violated. Joining me in New York are Slate's chief political correspondent John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello.
And Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
A dramatic constitutional storm is gathering in Washington. Senator Dianne Feinstein, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has accused the CIA of spying on Senate staffers who are investigating CIA's interrogation policies. The implications of Feinstein's accusations are enormous. As we're going to discuss, the CIA is barred from domestic intelligence gathering. It appears to be collecting information domestically. It also appears to be undercutting an investigation by the legislative branch, which potentially undermines the very foundation of separation of powers. It's a complicated story. It's not just Feinstein's side. The CIA has a very different view of what's going on. Let's begin, John Dickerson, you wrote about this week, with trying to explain the background and the charges and countercharges at work here. Emily, interrupt as needed.
Yeah,
with
please,
some legal mumbo jumbo.
Yeah, please do. It's what's great about this story is that it's accusations of criminal activity. It's not just a tussle between two branches of government, as the founders predicted over 200 years ago. What you essentially have happening is the Senate Intelligence Committee, since 2006, has been looking into the interrogation techniques that were a part of the response to 9/11. That interrogation program started in 2002. The Intelligence Committee didn't find out about it until 2006. So as we talk about this, the key thing to remember is that the Intelligence Committee is the one that's supposed to oversee all of these secret activities, not just by the CIA, but by the NSA. And so that is important here, and we'll talk about that later. Anyway, in 2006, they start to investigate these interrogation techniques. By 2009, they have a preliminary report which turns out that the interrogation techniques are far more vast and worrisome than they ever knew.
And we're basically talking about Bush-era torture.
Bush-era torture. Exactly. Waterboarding. Rendition 2, is that a part of this, right? Okay, so what happens then in 2009 is the Intelligence Committee launches yet another full investigation, and it takes place at this offsite, a CIA offsite in which a network is set up separate and apart from the CIA on which investigators are supposed to do their work. And they get 6.2 million pieces of documentation from the CIA. Now, according to Senator Feinstein, who gave a TikTok of this whole saga on the floor of the Senate, which was kind of extraordinary. And what's most extraordinary, of course, are her accusations at the end of it. But she went to explain the whole thing. So we're in the 2009 period, 2010 period. They start to investigate on this network at this offsite. And they are going through all these documents. According to Senator Feinstein, the CIA is not helpful at all. They require each document to
be... No search tool at first. It's like a huge document dump of
right.
the kind that really blocks people from seeing if there's this needle in the haystack.
And anything that they look at in the documentation must be kind of scrubbed a couple of times by various people at the CIA to make sure that it doesn't give away sources and methods before they can even look at it to make an assessment. Included in this document dump is something called the Panetta Review, named after then CIA Director Leon Panetta. That review is essentially the Cliff Notes version of the 6.2 million pages of documentation to the director, and it is scathing and incredibly damning of the CIA's work.
Right. It's not just a summary. It sounds like it has a lot of analysis and judgment along the way, and it makes the kind of accusations and indictments of what the CIA was doing, which the Senate Intelligence Committee then picked up on, and so they were actually consistent with each other.
And let's be specific about that. What that is. So the accusations are both of the nature of what is it that the CIA did. So what is the nature of the interrogation policies and torture it's carried out? And then, most importantly, was this effective? What did this lead to useful intelligence? That, so those are the two things that are at issue.
Super important. That's exactly right. That's what's being investigated while all this other shenanigans is going on, and that's exactly right. So in 2010, the investigators for the Senate start to notice that stuff starts to disappear from their network. Now, there are all kinds of special arrangements that have taken place between the Senate investigators and the CIA on how to handle information. And there's only supposed to be CIA sort of IT department have access to this network. So the fact that stuff starts disappearing is worrisome because it suggests that analysts at the CIA or somebody outside of the IT department is monkeying with it. Feinstein goes to the CIA. They blame it on some contractors. Then they say the White House said that they should do this. The White House, of course, says, no, we didn't. She gets it straightened out. In 2012, they release a 6,300-page summary of the work that the investigators have done.
They don't release it.
No, I'm sorry.
They write it up,
and it's secret. The CIA then responds with 122 pages that was released in January of this year.
Also not released.
The CIA agrees with some of what the investigators, but also disagrees with great chunks of it. What shocks them is that it totally contradicts the so-called Panetta review. So the review that the CIA, secret review the CIA wrote for the director, is much harsher about what the CIA was doing than this 122-page thing, which is written, even though it's secret now, there is a lot of discussion about making it public. So it's written with an eye to being made public. At this point, the Senate investigators say, well, this is crazy. Your official response is very different than the Panetta review. And they get worried because the Panetta review, while they were finishing up their report, has disappeared from the network. So this is now the second instance where there's been some monkeying on going on with what's on the network. Fortunately for investigators, by the way they see it, they've printed out the Panetta review because they've been given clearance to print out some things that they think are particularly important. The rub is they're not allowed to take it from the secret CIA location back to the Hart Senate office building. Or if they're going to do that, they have to run it by the CIA scrubbers and the CIA folks have to say it's okay to do this. In this case, they don't, because they're worried because stuff's been disappearing off the network and because the CIA destroyed tapes of this waterboarding going on, that this is the kind of evidence the CIA is trying to destroy. So they sneak it out, take it to the Hart Senate office building, put it in a safe where it now sits. When Feinstein and the other investigators read the 122-page response from the CIA, they say, can we get the official Panetta report because we see – so she's now asking for it officially. And the CIA says, no, this is secret. And the CIA – and now I'm coming to the conclusion here. The CIA says, wait a minute. How do you have the Panetta documents?
How do you even know to ask for it?
Yeah. How do you know to ask for it? You never should have had it. Based on the fact they took the Panetta report, which they were never supposed to have, and took it to the Hart Senate office building off-site, the CIA then uses this as a pretext to then – go into their computers, this according to Senator Feinstein, but she said she was told by CIA Director John Brennan that they did this. They go into the computers to see what else they may have taken, thus investigating the investigators, which then caused her, Senator Feinstein, to go nuts. Then, final stage of this, the Inspector General of the CIA looks into this, says there's enough here to go make a referral to the Department of Justice to look into these CIA guys who broke into the computer system of the Senate investigators.
Well, plus, though, meanwhile, the CIA is also trying to open a criminal investigation into this act of removing the Panetta review and taking it out of the CIA network.
Meanwhile, the acting CIA general counsel launches this criminal investigation with the Justice Department and Senator Feinstein on the Senate floor. So she's accused them of hacking into their stuff, stealing documents, and now accuses the acting general counsel of the CIA of launching that criminal investigation because his name is in the
Senate
torture report 1,600 times. So, in other words, he's trying to stonewall this because he's personally implicated in those things David so rightly brought up before, which is, did they break the law and was any of this torture worth it?
So here's what I keep coming back to in this. How is it possible to sympathize with the CIA here? because what they're trying to prevent is the Senate Intelligence Committee, their oversight body, from having access to an internal review they wrote themselves assessing the legality and the circumstances of this tour. We've had such an era of lack of transparency. The only kind of fig leaf we have are these congressional oversight committees. And here we have the agency that should be investigated, essentially blocking access, using these intimidating tactics to, you know, get the investigators in trouble. It is so unappealing if you're a citizen trying to see how the branches can possibly be providing enough of a watchdog role here over the spies.
Right. Emily, I have a constitutional question here, which is we have a standoff between these two bodies, and the Department of Justice has now been dragooned into it. But the Department of Justice is essentially like a sister of the
CIA, part of the executive branch.
So how do conflicts like this get worked out?
Usually there's this unwritten set of rules that govern how congressional oversight committees deal with these sensitive executive branch matters. There's a sort of two-step. And one of the ironies to me here is the role of Dianne Feinstein here. She has been the biggest enabler of our spies, the NSA, the CIA, of anyone in the Senate. I mean, I have just been so disgusted by the degree to which she has been an apologist for the overreaching of the NSA and the CIA. So to have her upset really demonstrates that things are out of control here. And you have this feeling if she couldn't figure out how to work with John Brennan, who she has, you know, when she has been so cozied up to this agency, then no one could have. And we really do desperately need Congress to assert its authority in this dramatic and overt way, which will make it harder, at least, for them to back down. Because I assume they are the ones who will back down. That's always what happens.
Who is going to back down?
Congress. Congress, except for the Church Committee hearings after Watergate, where there was this sense of real public, you know, turmoil and dismay over the overreaching of J. Edgar Hoover's FBI and the Nixon administration. That is the one moment where Congress
truly
asserted.
And also, there's 6 months left because once the Republicans take the Senate,
this will be over.
In November 2014, this is going to be over.
And already the senators on the committee are not. Only Lindsey Graham has been supporting Feinstein, right?
Well, there's an interesting split that because Daryl Issa and Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz and a couple of others have been supportive,
but
Chambliss
is
the ranking member, although who's leaving, but who's the ranking member has been kind of like, well, it's all murky. We don't know. So it'll be an interesting split along those kind of national security lines and civil liberties lines that we've been poking
at.
Although
it's weird, because usually senators are so keen on protecting senatorial privilege.
But they're
why would they ever defend the CIA?
No,
why would they ever defend
well,
the CIA?
No, but they're not. Congress always loses these battles because Congress is this fractious, cacophonous body that is not good at having a real, in this moment, a united front. And to take on the CIA is to take on this agency that is supposed to be protecting American soil. It starts to all the patriotism, militaristic drumbeats start to roll, and Congress usually backs off.
But let's say, Emily, that Congress doesn't back off. What is the next step in this?
Well, I mean, the Justice Department has to decide which, if any, of these criminal cases to bring. Presumably, they will want to have nothing to do with any of it. And then the question is there some way that either Feinstein or the CIA, more likely Feinstein, could dragoon the courts into getting involved? And if she felt like the CIA had blocked her access, she couldn't get what she needed, I suppose that she'd figure out some way to challenge the agency in court. That seems so unlikely to me.
Also, there are a lot of different things to work out here. So there's the question of, did you snoop in my computers? That's one big question. But the other is, is the original Panetta review going to be released to Congress?
Right.
And that's
or
the most damning.
Or is someone going to leak it?
Well, exactly. Is somebody going to leak it? Then what happens to the 6,200 page? Because they Do we ever get to see that? And back to David's point about the Republicans taking over Congress.
And why can't she just release that on her own? I mean, I know that there's this tradition of deference, but why can't she? I guess it's all classified. That's the reason.
Yeah, I think
the executive branch can classify stuff on its own, and then she has to abide by that.
I'm totally with you, John, about this Feinstein question where people are saying, oh, you know, she only cares when it's her prerogatives. But I think it is legitimate for her to support what the NSA is doing and still to be upset about this.
Yeah,
this is foundational.
Except that the problem she's having here, give the lie to all of her reassurances before, because these same kinks were in the system all along. It's just that this has blown up in this particularly antagonistic way. And frankly, you know, you could argue, I don't have the evidence for this, but I'll say say it anyway. The reason the CIA is being so bellicose here is that they've been given so much rope over the years, and they're emboldened to, you know, go so far as to vanish documents from computers and then charge the very Senate staffers with having violated criminal law.
Coming up, is the president allowed to be funny, or is that undignified? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political Gabfest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. President Obama killed it on Between Two Ferns, Zach Galifianakis's mock talk show, the show in which Galifianakis plays a talk show host who's an aggressive moron, oaf, allowed Obama a chance to highlight healthcare.gov, presumably to an audience of younger people, that the administration really needs, wants, and needs to sign up for Obamacare. And it seemed to have worked in the sense that Obamacare, or the healthcare.gov, has seen an increase in web traffic in the days since the video clip was shown. It was really funny, I thought. Did you guys agree that it was really funny?
Yeah, it was a good Between Two Ferns episode, right? Which is what the director and Zach Galifianakis, or however you say his name, kept insisting that they were really after. I don't know how they could have not aired the tape if it had sucked, but it worked.
So, Emily, Bill O'Reilly, a noted American political commentator, said this was a disgrace, that Abraham Lincoln would never have done this. Abraham Lincoln is rolling over in his grave. It has disgraced the office of the presidency. It's undignified. Is it?
I am all for less dignity, I suppose. I mean, in general, I'm not so interested in pomp and circumstance, and I always want to bring people down to earth. So I have a predilection in favor of this. But I think, and this is not my original idea, the Abraham Lincoln historical example, I think, is wrong, because Lincoln was actually a great communicator, and he would have, if he was alive now, he'd be picking up on whatever is the best way to reach these young hipsters who are not signing up for health insurance. Let's go and find them. You know, when you think about it that way, it seems pretty genius. It seems like something any president could do. And, you know, there is a tradition of presidents going on, what, Saturday Night Live, some of these other shows. Obama's been on Late Night before, and he's not the first one. And usually it's just not as good, right? They go on Jon Stewart and they kind of tank because they're not really willing to play the game.
Right.
What worked about this so well was that Obama had obviously watched the show and got into the spirit of it.
Here's a question I wondered. So Stephen Colbert set the modern tradition of speaking truth to power when at the White House Correspondents' Dinner he made, you know, jokes about the president who was sitting inches away from him.
God bless him.
There were some people who were saying that's what, you know, comedians are supposed to make people in power feel uncomfortable. This was suggested by Galifianakis. This was being the handmaiden of the administration. Do you, either of you, find that problematic? So not from the president's side, but from
the comedian
was
essentially too in on the joke. I mean, I don't think that Galifianakis was going after Obama here at all.
Yeah.
I think you're right. And he has said, or the director has said, you know, we're all for people signing up for health insurance. I do think, though, that, you know, essentially saying to the president, your people, you completely screwed up this website, is not what you're
that.
Not.
Who hasn't
I know
said
that,
that
everyone knows that, but to say it to the president's face on camera is, you don't give him any credit for that.
No, not at all. And I would say, here's what I would say. I actually want to blame the president here, because I don't think it's up to Galifianakis. Not every comedian, every situation has to speak truth to power. What I object to is that the White House does this. White House sits for this interview, gets all this. White House never does any interviews with real journalists. You know, once in a blue moon, they submit to something. You know, Obama spoke to O'Reilly at the Super Bowl. That was okay.
Clearly,
but basically,
pained the entire time.
You know, basically, they never let actual journalists cross-examine the president. And I sort of deplore the fact that they spend his time on this stuff and not actually letting journalists at him.
Right. So, it's not either or. It's both. That they should have paired this with some moment where they let some eager conservative reporter ask hard questions.
Well, or just a regular. You know, they get off the hook on conservative, too, because they can say, oh, well, you know, of course they're going to ask IRS Benghazi and healthcare.gov questions because they're just. So it's easier for them to dismiss that than sitting down. You know, when was the last time he had an interview with, say, The Times or The Post?
I don't think he's done a Times interview. Years, I think. I really think it's years. What are the other things that Obama should do in this vein?
You mean on the comedy? It depends.
The Slate Political Gap Fest, we'd be willing to.
We would have him on.
Yeah.
Is that comedy or journalism?
I don't know.
The thing also is they were talking about how their web traffic went up. We'll see at the end of the month if they actually sign anybody up. I mean, they've been so stingy with the numbers and the specificity. So they expected about 40% of their signups. They wanted 40% of their signups to be the 18 to 35 year cohort. And I think it turns out it's close to 30. So they're well below. So they need this.
And they're at like 4 point something million and they're trying to get to seven by the end of the month. We'll see.
That'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in New York. The Culture GabFest starts right now.
This is GabFest Radio. I'm Julia Turner. On this week's Slate Culture GabFest, we'll talk about Wes Anderson's latest film, The Grand Budapest Hotel, and the director's moral evolution, or lack thereof. We'll also talk about Neil deGrasse Tyson's new series, Cosmos, for Fox. Is it TV spectacle or fascinating science? And finally, we'll be joined by Reuters finance blogger Felix Salmon to discuss Bitcoin, the promise and potential problems of the fledgling cryptocurrency, and the recent Newsweek article claiming to out its creator. Joining me today is Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hi, Dana.
Hey, Julia.
And Steve is out this week, so David Haglund, Slate's browbeat editor, is sitting in.
Hi, Julia.
How are you?
Good.
Okay, well, let's start with Grand Budapest Hotel. Dana, you are our film critic. Tell us what you thought.
Grand Budapest Hotel is a Wes Anderson film, and it seems that it's impossible to discuss any Wes Anderson film without immediately making it a referendum on all of Wes Anderson. So I'll preface my opinion of Grand Budapest Hotel by saying that in general, I would say I'm tremendously drawn toward Wes Anderson's aesthetic, and I find him fascinating, and I'm always excited to see what he does next. But I have been disappointed by almost every one of his films. There are only two Wes Anderson movies that I love unreservedly, Rushmore and Fantastic Mr. Fox, which we can talk about later. And this is not among them. In fact, this would not make my top five Wes Anderson films. I think Grand Budapest Hotel is sort of an overconceived, overly decorated, overly fussy, beautiful object that gives you many moments of joy while watching it, but that ultimately has something missing, something really important missing that seems to be missing from a lot of Wes Anderson movies, and we can get to what that is. But it has to do with the way he depicts suffering, emotion, things that lie outside of the perfectly controlled universes that he creates.
I think that's super interesting, and I think we should argue about whether this movie keeps that suffering at bay or actually incorporates it in a really interesting way. But let's start maybe by just giving some contours of the plot. David, you want to walk us through?
Sure. There's a somewhat complicated nesting structure. It opens with a young woman who has this book called The Grand Budapest Hotel, which is by someone just listed as author. Then we see the author in his old age saying that many of his stories were brought to him by other people. Cut to the author when he's younger, played by Jude Law, who then meets this man in the Grand Budapest Hotel. This man is Zero Mustafa, and he owns the hotel. And he tells author about the story that happened to him when he was young, and he was a lobby boy, and he worked for a man named Gustav H., who's played by Ralph Fiennes. And that's the main story, is Gustav H. is a dandy of a sort. He's a concierge.
It's 1932, we should say. We're basically moving back a generation or so with each of these nested narratives.
Right, and there are these soldiers who are like Nazis, though they're not called that, and they don't have swastikas. Instead, they have these little zigzags that remind you of swastikas that are eventually going to, you know, lay waste to this mythical, fictional Eastern European country, which is called Zubravka. That's where the hotel is. Gustav H. is also fond of the many elderly aristocratic ladies who stay at the Grand Budapest Hotel, and he seems to start affairs with many of them. Some of them then give him money. One of them is played by Tilda Swinton. She plays a woman named Madame D. She dies and leaves him a painting and perhaps all of her money. But her family wants to stop Gustav H. from seizing either the painting or the money, and they try to kill him.
David, you did a marvelous job with the plot. What did you think of the movie?
I love the movie. I mean, I am a little warmer on Wes Anderson in general than Dana is. I wouldn't list his movies among my all-time favorites, but I like all of them. And prior to this one, my favorite was probably Moonrise Kingdom, which was his previous movie. And now I would say this one is. I think it's...
You think he's getting better and growing as an artist with each movie, which is precisely what I don't think about him. I mean, he's growing. He's growing in all sorts of incredible ways, but I have this feeling that he's not growing... I don't know how to say it. It doesn't sound so touchy-feely, but kind of morally or spiritually or something.
Right, which is precisely where we disagree, because you said there's something missing in this movie, and I would say that something is very deliberately missing from this movie. It is very deliberately buried, not ignored, but in a way hidden. I mean, in a way off-screen. but the characters gesture towards it, and much of the pathos of the movie, I think, is in those gestures.
I actually think this may be my favorite Wes Anderson movie as well, because I think that in the same way that you use a dollhouse to tell a story, this is a different way of using film to tell a story, right? It's not the classic, like, big, quivering, tearful face, like, 20 feet high on the screen in front of you that just sucks you in and pulls the tears from your eyes as well. This is a different type of storytelling and arresting and visually beautiful and completely delightful to look at and also to listen to.
The music.
The
oh
music
God.
Is gorgeous, and even the writing is so fun. Why don't we actually pause for a minute to just hear how Ralph Fiennes performs this role?
I'm not leaving.
I beg your pardon?
I'm not leaving.
Why not?
I'm frightened.
Of what?
I fear this may be the last time we ever see each other.
Why on earth would that be the case?
Well, I can't put it into words, but I feel it.
Well, for goodness sake, there's no reason for you to leave us if you'd rather...
Come with me.
To f***ing Lutz.
Please.
Give me your hand. You've nothing to fear. You're always anxious before you travel. I admit you appear to be suffering a more acute attack on this occasion, but truly and honestly... Oh, dear God, what have you done to your fingernails?
I beg your pardon?
This diabolical varnish, the colour is completely wrong.
Oh, really? Don't you like it?
It's not that I don't like it. I am physically repulsed.
Can you imagine getting that script on your desk and having the prospect of performing it in front of you? Can you think of anything more fun as an actor?
I have a couple of responses to that, and I'm not trying to throw cold water because I actually think everyone can see this movie because it's fun, but I think Ralph Fiennes is investing with his great performance a lot of lines that might on paper not live. And I also think that although his character, M. Gustav, is one of the best characters Wes Anderson has ever written, I think he's living in a universe that is of characters that are not as strong, which is a weakness of the movie.
That may be true, but just to finish my thought, I feel like Wes Anderson is putting together this miniature world to evoke and conjure how these people actually deal with the pain and suffering in their own lives. So that for both Zero, who we learn midway through the film is himself a refugee from war, from seeing his family murdered and executed, and for Gustav H., whose origins we never learned that much about, but who clearly is a self-invented character, they find in the rhythms and rituals and routines of the hotel and sort of the craft of putting together a flawless and incredible experience for the guests, emotional refuge from the pain and suffering of their lives. And they find that the building of this world is itself something to cling to and to cohere around emotionally. And I find that very powerful. John Swansburg, who's a frequent guest on the show, wrote a post for Browbeat arguing that in some ways Gustav H. is perhaps a stand-in for Wes Anderson, that this movie is Wes Anderson defending his own career and oeuvre and saying that the pursuit of perfection in all details is itself a noble pursuit. I think that's an interesting argument, but I actually thought that it read to me even more broadly as an argument that not giving up on the little details of your life is a way to fight pain, suffering, fascism, totalitarianism, that caring about how you make a pastry or how you treat an elderly guest who's grumpy is actually a noble and powerful thing to do in the world. And there are ways in which I believe that. I think he may be right.
I think that he sees it as an art. And so his filmmaking is also an embodiment of that same ethos. So I see it both as you see it and as John does, that Gustav does remind me of Anderson, his attention to details. And people criticize Anderson for only caring about the details. And this movie, I think maybe more than any of his others, makes clear that he sees those details and that fussiness and that aesthetic quality that all his movies have as connected to pain, suffering, emotion. And he is interested in the gestures, but he's also interested in what's underneath them.
We persuaded you, Dana.
Fine, it's a masterpiece. It's the greatest movie he's ever made. I should say, feel a very strong need to see it again. I feel like it's really layered and dense, and all those narrative Chinese boxes we were talking about are kind of difficult to remember how they're structured. So I'm going to see it again, and maybe I'll feel differently.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that it's just hilarious. It's just really funny and zippy, and it's kind of short. Actually, I wanted to sit there for another hour and watch more.
Yeah, I mean, the sheer pleasure of the texture of it, of every single line reading of Ralph Fiennes in the whole movie, literally every single one made me chuckle, to myself internally at least, if not out loud.
Yeah, I think anyone would be hard-pressed not to enjoy the movie, whether or not they have the kinds of questions you do, Dana, or whether or not they connect with it emotionally in the way I did. It's just immensely enjoyable.
Absolutely. And I'm not talking about things that keep me from enjoying Wes Anderson movies and looking forward to each new one. It's what keeps me from putting him in my personal pantheon of beloved artists. Except for Fantastic Mr. Fox and Rushmore.
Fair enough. All right. Well, the movie again is Wes Anderson's Grand Budapest Hotel. It opened on Friday in New York and L.A. and is going to open wider over the next few weeks. Coming up, The New Cosmos. Is it scientific truth or TV spectacle? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Julia Turner, along with Dana Stevens and David Haglund, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for things we mention on the program, we collect them on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please leave a comment while you're there. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, moving on to Neil deGrasse Tyson's new series, Cosmos. It is a very self-conscious remake of Carl Sagan's series Cosmos, which he did on PBS in 1980. And it tries to kind of take the popular science mantle from Carl Sagan for a new generation, updating it with everything scientists have learned in the last 30-odd years and possibly reframing the conversation a little bit for today's political environment around science, I felt. But before we get too far into the series and how we liked it, let's listen to a clip first of the new Neil deGrasse Tyson Cosmos.
To make this journey, we'll need imagination. But imagination alone is not enough, because the reality of nature is far more wondrous than anything we can imagine. This adventure is made possible by generations of searchers strictly adhering to a simple set of rules. Test ideas by experiment and observation. Build on those ideas that pass the test. Reject the ones that fail. Follow the evidence wherever it leads, and question everything. Accept these terms, and the cosmos is yours. Now, come with me.
So I'm curious, David, what did you think of the show?
I guess my initial response is that it's not really for me. You know, I thought it seemed so well-intentioned and generally, you know, well done. The production values are high. Neil deGrasse Tyson, I think, is a very charming and forceful narrator, and he carries the authority of an actual, actual scientist. And he brings that up at the end when he tells this amazing story about something that Carl Sagan did for him, and it's very sweet and touching. At the same time, the science in the first episode remains fairly basic, right? I mean, if this is going to educate somebody, you know, I'm picturing an 11-year-old, a 10-year-old, someone who's maybe swept up in, you know, in the cosmos and in these shots of the planets forming and in this kind of goofy spaceship, the spaceship of the imagination, which Tyson flies around in, and which is, taken directly from the original Carl Sagan. Although I think it's been updated. It looks a little different
this
time.
It looks like he's flying around in like a mid-90s era pager to me.
That is exactly right. And as a 35-year-old, I thought, well, I hope that, you know, some kids see this and decide they want to be scientists. But if it came on the TV, I might change the channel. I found the almost constant, bombastic scoring and the tone of awe and wonder that is sustained almost steadily for the 45 minutes or so of the program, I found that a bit wearing.
Yeah, it is a little bit as though you're in a Spielberg movie the whole time. Like, new worlds are forming, and I think the childlike faces lighting up with glee that would be in the Spielberg movie are supposed to be us watching at home, I think. And I agreed that tonally it didn't feel quite like it was aimed at my wheelhouse. Dana, what did you think?
I mean, this is how I described it to my man after watching the pilot and him asking, so should I be following this Neil deGrasse Tyson thing? If you can put up with the level of kitsch of the presentation, which really, it really does get into the realm of kitsch. I mean, every single shot has to be Neil deGrasse Tyson balancing on the rings of Saturn, right? Neil deGrasse Tyson, standing in his pager being zoomed out into space. And, all the music is incredibly bombastic. I mean, you really have to penetrate through a lot of layers of kind of irritating, kitschy presentation. There's some really good learning in there. I mean, it takes about 10 to 12 minutes before the first fact comes along that you don't know if you kind of have a basic science education and you're not 11 or 12 years old. But once he kind of starts to get into, the cosmic calendar, for example, that we heard in that clip, that was also in the original, the Carl Sagan Cosmos. But it's a really, really clever pop science way of presenting that fact that you just talked about, right? If you imagine that we're in a year, and January 1st was the Big Bang, and, you know, right now we're at December 31st, then the way he phrases it essentially is that only for the last 14 seconds of the year before the new year would turn over has there been recorded history, right? And then when that's sort of illustrated graphically and visually, it does give you a sense of cosmological sweep, and it's very effective at it. When he gets into the history of science and some of the, especially some of the religion-related, you know, Inquisition-related stories, I feel like that's the moment that it is a little bit dumbed down. I don't think in general that the science is actually dumbed down, but the historiography kind of is, in a way that maybe that's just because it's something that I'm more familiar with, right, talking about how history is presented. But there was something I thought a little bit condescending about this. A man named Lucretius, you know, like we're capable of understanding that he's an ancient Roman and he's a scientist and getting a little bit more context than sort of presenting the history of science as, you know, three different guys corresponding with each other.
Well, and there's an unfortunate bit of characterization. They tell the story of Giordano Bruno, and he's tried for something along the lines of heresy. I forget the exact nature of the charges as they were framed, but the judge who's seen questioning him is such a cartoonish villain. And to my mind, that's
That animated sequence. Oh, it's so cheesy.
There are many problems with the animated sequence. One of them, for me, was that the judge probably didn't speak like, you know, Scar from The Lion King or something, right? I mean, he probably seemed like a, you know, run-of-the-mill authority figure, perhaps. And that actually would be a much more striking, you know, way of presenting that scene, because the people who are opposed to science now, as they were then, don't necessarily speak that way. If they did, we would all, you know, listen.
They don't have like flickering clouds of doom over their head as lightning crashes around.
Not the ones that I've seen. And I have to say, I mean, I think that the people who come into this with any skepticism about, you know, the nature of the universe and when it was created, I'm very skeptical myself that they would be persuaded, because this show works so much by awe, by impressing you, right? And it doesn't actually do that much persuading, which is fine as television goes. I mean, I don't need persuading on the subject, and I think that it's good if people see this and get excited about it. But it doesn't actually present much of an argument. It says this is the way things are. He brings up the scientific method early, and, you know, to his credit, and says, you know, we need to test things, we need to question everything, and I believe that. And then, you know, now I will wow you with these incredible shots of the cosmos, and you will take my word for it, which I do. But if
right.
I didn't, he wouldn't have won me over.
I mean, I have to say, the story of Giordano Bruno, which I had never heard before, is incredible. It may be cheesily told. It may be told for political reasons. I would like to see a real movie, a biopic about Giordano Bruno, because the idea of someone just essentially dreaming a cosmos that turned out to be scientifically accurate is incredible. So again, I sort of wish that the show had been a little bit better at establishing context and, for example, told us, where did Giordano Bruno write about this? You know, if we wanted to know more about him, and of course we can go research him, but I didn't think that it did a great job of taking more of a historical perspective and saying, like, here's what Giordano Bruno actually wrote and said.
And even with the science, you don't always get the deeper detail. So, for example, when we're learning about the cosmic calendar, right, and we're learning about how late in the cosmic calendar our particular sun emerged, which is sometime in August, and then, you know, how did the Earth form? How did the Moon form? There's a bit where Neil deGrasse Tyson stops and points out that it's two asteroids collided somewhere early on there, and that collision of the asteroid would go on to change everything. And then the Earth forms, and then it's suggested slightly later in the show that that same asteroid that had been nudged earlier by the fledgling Earth is the same asteroid that
came
comes
back and
around
kills the dinosaur,
which is crazy if it's true. But is that how? Is that true? Like, how would we even know that? I wanted a little bit more of the science. I mean, how did people figure that out? That seems like a crazy coincidence, and one that would be very difficult to understand or comprehend, given that we only very recently in the history of science figured out the asteroid theory of the end of the dinosaurs at all. And so I couldn't tell if that was like a metaphor for how asteroids might have interacted in the formation of Earth, or a very specific and interesting revelation about the formation of the planet and the end of the dinosaurs. And I'm not sure if I'm going to get the answer. Maybe if I keep watching, I will. But
you're right. That's attributing a lot of kind of will to that asteroid. It's like revenge of the asteroid. It can't be the same one. It's just a piece of rock falling through space.
Well, it could, but maybe it had some kind of orbit. I don't know. These are the kinds of questions that I want a science documentary to answer for me. And it may be that this was the intro episode that was pitched at a baseline level. And if I stick with it, I'm eventually going to really get the meat of that story. But I'm a little concerned that they're just going to go ahead to like animals, and I'm going to get some fascinating facts thrown at me about animals. I think the answer is I'm just going to need to email Phil Plait, Slate's astronomy blogger, and get him to do a post about it and answer my question after the show.
You know, this highlights for me why I think the show is good for 11 and 12-year-olds, and I realize it's not because they know less science. And in fact, I'm realizing now that I probably knew this stuff better when I was 11 and 12 than I do now. But maybe if I saw it then, or if, you know, some hypothetical kid who sees it and gets so excited about it, they'll go off and try to understand that themselves in a way that I'm not going to do. I want somebody to tell me what really happened. Maybe an 11-year-old says, wait a second, I want to understand that, and they embark on a career in science.
All right. Well, the show again is Cosmos from Neil deGrasse Tyson. It's airing on Fox and the National Geographic Channel. You should check it out and let us know what you think on our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. For our final segment, we're joined by Felix Salmon, the renowned and unintroducible finance blogger at Reuters. Welcome, Felix.
Thank you.
So we wanted to talk about Bitcoin this week because it's all everybody is talking about. But we were forced to confront the fact that all of us have been harboring the secret that we basically don't understand what Bitcoin is or why anyone would be interested in it in the first place prior to Newsweek's revelation that they think they found the Bitcoin creator and the mass internet's suspicion that perhaps Newsweek hadn't actually, and the furor and all the news and craziness last week. So can we just start with total basics, Mr. Finance Blogger?
We can, but the dirty secret of the entire internet is that no one really understands Bitcoin. I wrote a 5,000-word article about it last year, and I didn't understand it. I still don't. There's depths and depths and depths to it, and whenever you say anything skeptical about Bitcoin, you get the Bitcoin faithful coming out and saying, you don't understand, and the answer to that is, well, that's the point. But basically, at heart, it's, they call it digital gold. It's a finite resource of cryptographic codes which exist in the internet. And you can trade them. You can sell them for money. You sell them to someone else and they'll pay you money for it. And they're worth whatever people think they're worth.
Right, which has fluctuated wildly in the last couple of years, right?
Which has fluctuated anywhere from $1 to $1,000 over the past couple of years, yeah.
Right. An additional part of the appeal is that if I have a Bitcoin, something about the way it's set up as a piece of code is such that I can't just like cut and paste it on my desktop and then I'm the one with all 21 million Bitcoin, right?
Exactly. The genius of Bitcoin, the problem which was solved by this Satoshi Nakamoto, is what's known as the double spending problem, that you can't just copy your Bitcoin and spend it three times. Once you've spent it, that expenditure is recorded in something called the blockchain, and now the person you sent it to can spend it, but you can't.
Right. So this was like a difficult technical coding problem that the creators of Bitcoin, who for years have been shadowy and mysterious but have gone by the name
of Satoshi Nakamoto,
right, seem to have solved.
They
right.
did solve it.
They did that, solve that, it.
That it was a big problem and it was solved, and it was solved by this mysterious person called Satoshi Nakamoto, which everyone assumed was a pseudonym. And then everyone picked up his idea and ran with it, basically. And in a sense, it doesn't matter who he is, because the main work that he did, which was solving this double spending problem, has been solved at this point.
So I think that brings us to the Newsweek story, right? So Newsweek went out of print for a while. Now, through a circuitous media story that we don't need to get into, is reemerging with a print issue and a new editor. And their first cover story was, hey, we found the guy who invented Bitcoin, pinning the creation of this cryptocurrency on a guy who's actually named Satoshi Nakamoto, but goes by Dorian, lives in California, is really interested in model trains, and whose history does line up with some of what we think we know about the originator of Bitcoin, but maybe not quite as completely or comprehensively as the Newsweek article argued or suggested.
What we know about the history of, about the inventor of Bitcoin, and I differentiate, distinguish these two, as I call one of them Satoshi and the other one Dorian. And so what we know about Satoshi is that he wrote this paper. That's the main number one thing we know about him. We don't really know much
else. The manifesto you're talking about.
The manifesto, the original Bitcoin. And then he was on message boards and would communicate with various Bitcoin developers, and especially in the early years. And so the question then is, does it make sense to believe that Dorian is the author of this paper? And that, you know, there's nothing in particular which makes us think that. I mean, do we know that Dorian is an expert in cryptography? Do we know that he has the ability to make this major scientific breakthrough in terms of solving the double spending problem? No, we don't. So the main sort of smoking gun that the Newsweek article had was this seeming confession that he made when he was standing in his driveway to the Newsweek reporter who was talking to him, and he said, I'm not involved in that anymore. I've handed it over to other people. And so she said he just admitted that he used to be involved in it, and so she splashed it all over the cover, and then he turned around and said, I wasn't even talking about Bitcoin. I didn't know what she was talking about. What is this Bitcoin? I've only heard about it for the first time 3 weeks ago. And so now we're in this literally he said, she said, who do you believe situation.
But of course, the founder of Bitcoin, being famous for his secrecy, would say that and would come out and deny all the allegations in the article. Then again, as you very reasonably point out, if he's so obsessed with secrecy, why would he have gone by his own name, Satoshi Nakamoto?
It's what I call the Satoshi paradox. If you believe that Dorian is Satoshi, you have to believe a lot of things which are kind of improbable. And if you believe that he isn't Satoshi, you also have to believe a whole bunch of things which are kind of improbable. And yet somehow you take these two unlikely things and the probabilities of them both together have to add up to 100%. So it's a little bit of a paradox there.
Right. I mean, the detail that everybody latched onto that I saw before people started raising questions about the story was that he liked to buy model trains from England, I think it was, and he hated how difficult it was to get them. And so, of course, this is the guy who would create Bitcoin because he wanted to get his model trains more conveniently and easily.
Did you find that convincing?
Not especially, but it was exactly the kind of picturesque detail that people love in stories like this. And part of what was appealing, I think, about the story is just that it made a great story.
I'm curious what you guys think about how this will play for the new Newsweek era if we never learn any more. If basically we're left with kind of a wash, maybe this story at best is right but couldn't totally prove it and maybe should have hedged its bets a bit more in the writing of it. At worst, is completely wrong and has misled us wildly. Given all that, does that make you think that this was a net negative for the new Newsweek era, or is it still a net positive because here we are all talking about Newsweek?
I find that really hard to say because actually if Newsweek was still just a website as it briefly was, if it hadn't gone back into print, I actually think this would be almost certainly a plus for them because they've gotten so much attention. I'm sure they've gotten a lot of traffic. But the truth is that print is a difficult thing to sustain, and part of what does sustain a print publication, I think, is trust and authority. And the idea that, you know, even if it's not going to be the first place that has a story, it's going to have this editorial process that we can all rely on and we believe in, and that, you know, gets things right more often than the internet does, supposedly.
Yeah, what the hell, David?
I'm just saying.
All right.
There's a kind of, I mean, the truth is ultimately I think it's survival or not as a print publication is probably more a financial matter, and I can't really say how this story folds into it. But I do think there is a way in which we trust. You know, I still see this, particularly among writers and editors, there's this idea that, oh, well, print publications have this process, and too many internet publications are, you know, taking shortcuts. And yet here, you know, here's a print publication getting it wrong, as print publications often have, honestly. And if they had hedged their bets, it still would have made a great story, people still would have read it, and maybe they only felt the pressure not to because they wanted to have this big splash on a cover.
I would be curious, too, to know how many print magazines this sold. I mean, were people mobbing the newsstand to grab their paper copy of Newsweek so that they could read about Satoshi Nakamoto? Because I read all about it on the web. It all seems to be out there. You can, you know, essentially read the article and every conversation about the article without ever laying hands on paper.
Have any of you actually seen the print copy of Newsweek?
Because Do we even know it exists? Newsweek is back in print, quote unquote. Felix, thank you so much for coming on and shedding light into the darkness.
Thank you.
All right, team, shall we endorse?
Ready.
All right, Dana, you commence.
So my endorsement is the extras on the Criterion DVD of Fantastic Mr. Fox, which include a whole bunch of storyboards of the original movie, a lot of little process featurettes where you see the puppets being crafted in London by these amazing puppeteers, I guess, and a whole lot of scenes also where Wes Anderson acts out the parts himself, which is apparently something he frequently does. I think he did it for Grand Budapest as well, where essentially he kind of physically personifies the characters and the animators get the idea from him. Talk about wanting more. I wanted another hour of extras on this DVD.
That sounds great. All right, David, what have you got for us?
I'm going to endorse. The musician is a woman named Sybil Bayer, or Sybil Bayer, maybe. Have you heard of her?
Mm-mm.
She's a German woman who, in the early 70s, made these home reel-to-reel recordings, very simple, beautiful songs. She recorded these in the early 70s, never put them out. Her son, 30 years later, put them together and gave copies to friends. And he also gave one to Jay Maskus, the Dinosaur Jr. frontman. And it ended up coming out on this small label that I believe is called Orange Twin. The album is called Color Green, and the song that I would recommend in particular is Tonight. So my endorsement is Tonight by Sybil Bayer.
That sounds amazing. All right, my endorsement this week, it's melting as we speak, so you have to race to get it as you can. But for various reasons, I've had occasion over the last couple weeks to walk through Central Park by the Reservoir, which is up in the 80s. And I've been going by in the early mornings, and the reservoir is basically still frozen because the winter has been so unremittingly cold. And there is just a small patch of unfrozen water on the southern edge of the reservoir. And in that patch is a preposterous number of wonderful birds. So if you like birds at all, or even if you don't know that you like them and you happen to be that way, you should pop over before it melts completely and see the wonderful concatenation of amazing ducks that there are to find. There are probably some interesting gulls as well, but I'm much less good at spotting gulls, and they're further out and harder to see, and I don't understand their markings. But I've seen hooded mergansers, which have these beautiful white markings on their heads, and buffleheads, which are teeny tiny ducks with bright white bottoms. So if you have a birding bone in your body but have not taken the opportunity to check out Central Park, now would be a good time to go hit the reservoir.
Can I just say that outdoes Steve Metcalf with the local endorsement. That's not only space-specific, it's time-specific. Only people who can get to Central Park in the next 6 hours can enjoy Julia's endorsement.
Well, I think more generally, we talked about this when we watched that Birding in Central Park documentary that aired on HBO a couple of years ago. We're entering the season of good birding in Central Park, and I'm not a super birder by a long shot. So I've never really done it, gone through Central Park during the migrant season. So anyway, take advantage if you happen to be in New York. David, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thanks for having me.
Dana, thank you.
Thanks, Julia.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, TuneIn, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Happerman and Mike Volo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Julia Turner. We'll talk to you next week.
Tonight, when I came home from work,